WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. The Louisa County Sheriff's Office says a missing girl has been found safe. The latest campaign finance reports show that lots of money is coming into Virginia from outside the Commonwealth in a very hotly contested election. And we trudge through the wet woods near Crozet as a wheel from a 60-year-old plane crash is returned to rest at the crash site. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, October 31st. The Louisa County Sheriff's Office says a missing girl has been found safe. 14-year-old Isabel Shea Hicks was found after a brief pursuit in Caroline County, north of Richmond. Bruce Lynch, 34, of Bumpus, was taken into custody after the chase, according to a news release from the Louisa County Sheriff's Office. Police said Hicks was taken from her home on October 21st and that she and Lynch knew each other. The statues of Confederate Generals Robert E. Lee and Thomas Stonewall Jackson in Charlottesville may have been damaged again. Chisel-like damage appears at the base of both statues. Previous damage was reported earlier this month and in September. The Charlottesville Police Department has not yet confirmed whether the damage is new. The previous incidents of damage remain under investigation. Governor Ralph Northam announced Wednesday that federal grant funds will be allocated to several universities in Virginia to help pilot substance use recovery programs for students. The University of Virginia and Longwood University are among the schools receiving the funds, with a program at Virginia Commonwealth University as the model. From Virginia Public Radio, Mallory Nopaine reports.
VCU's support program called RAMS in Recovery will be used as a model for similar programs at 8 other schools, including Virginia Union, Washington and Lee, UVA, and Virginia Tech.
College campuses are generally abstinence-hostile environments. The core reason for collegiate recovery is that students shouldn't have to choose between their recovery and their education.
Tom Bannard runs RAMS in Recovery. He says one of the main things a support group on campus does is help students find one another.
If you're a person in recovery, unless I tell you I'm in recovery, you don't know that I'm in recovery. So it's a hidden identity.
Michael Zohab manages the state's grant money for dealing with the opioid crisis. He says he's beyond excited to take a successful program and expand it to other schools.
The kids that are in these recovery programs are also the prevention programs in these colleges. They're the ones that are helping other kids and young adults seek a healthy lifestyle.
The participating schools will all get support and training from experts. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopaine.
The stakes are particularly high in the races for the state Senate this year. From Virginia Public Radio, Michael Pope reports on some of their fundraising efforts.
4 candidates for the Virginia State Senate have raised more than $1 million this campaign cycle. From the Richmond suburbs to Northern Virginia, big money campaign finance reports are an indication of how high the stakes are for Republicans who want to preserve their majority and for Democrats who want to seize power. Quentin Kidd at Christopher Newport University says it wasn't all that long ago that $1 million campaign finance report would have turned heads.
I can remember a time, literally not 2 or 3 or 4 election cycles ago, where the first Senate candidate raised $1 million and spent $1 million, and it was phenomenal and big news.
Republican incumbent Senator Glenn Sturdivant raised the most money, an indication that Republicans are on the defensive. The next highest fundraisers are 2 Democrats, one trying to unseat Sturdivant and the other trying to flip a red seat blue in an open district in Northern Virginia. Stephen Farnsworth at the University of Mary Washington says the money is an indication of what's at stake.
These narrow Republican majorities have convinced both parties that it's time to pull out all the stops, raise every dollar you possibly can to compete, because this could be a pivotal moment in Virginia.
Democrats only need to flip 2 seats to take the majority in the state Senate. That means both sides will be narrowly focused on a handful of hotly contested Senate seats in the Richmond suburbs and in Northern Virginia that could determine the balance of power next year. I'm Michael Pope.
The first legal commercial hemp crop in Virginia since 1937 is ready for harvest. Farmers in the Commonwealth appear eager to learn how hemp fares as a cash crop, as Charles Fishburne with VPM News reports.
Hemp is now being harvested on farms in every corner of the state.
As of October 25th, VDEX has issued 1,139 grower registrations, 247 processor registrations, and 105 dealer registrations.
Aaron Williams, Virginia Department of Agriculture, says hemp is cannabis without the high.
No greater than 0.3% THC.
Amendments to the Virginia hemp law this year eliminated the requirement that hemp be grown only for research and permitted the production of industrial hemp. But this year's crop is still an experiment.
I am hearing of some successful crops in Virginia.
Industrial hemp is used for fiber, grain, and floral varieties, which produce CBD oil used in health products. Charles Fishburne, WMRA News.
Finally today, 60 years ago, a Piedmont airliner crashed into Buck's Elbow Mountain near Crozet, killing 26 of the 27 people on board. On Wednesday, one of the plane's landing gear wheels was returned to rest at the crash site. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee was there and filed this report.
George W. Lavering, co-pilot, Bascom Lee Haley.
These are a few of the names of those who died on Buck's Elbow Mountain on October 30th, 1959. Yesterday, more than a dozen people huddled by the remainder of the wrecked fuselage on a steep, wooded slope commemorating the passengers of Piedmont Flight 349. It was cool and foggy, as it had been on that day 60 years ago. A landing gear wheel had been taken from the site shortly after the crash and passed through different hands over the years before coming to local artist Mark Klein.
Philip Bradley, the sole survivor, he got in contact with me a few years ago, and he wanted me to do something with this wheel once he found out that I had acquired it. This is just, I think, the best way to honor these people.
Bradley passed away in 2013, but Klein never forgot the promise he'd made.
I really feel good that we were able to, you know, put this back into place. I feel like this is where it really belongs. Couldn't have done it without the team of people that showed up, really good people, a lot of muscle, a lot of people that were dedicated. I mean, it wasn't real easy to get down that mountain.
To get it down the mountain, they suspended the wheel, which weighs more than 250 pounds, in a rolling framework made from a large steel spool. Five or six people at a time guided it through the woods, over logs and rocks, slipping their way down over wet leaves. One of the volunteers, Dave Wetzel, is the nephew of Lewis Sheffield, who died in the crash.
He was on his way to our house in Roanoke, Virginia, to visit with us for the weekend. My aunt was there. We were waiting for his plane to arrive at the airport. I was 9 years old when he passed, and he was never had any children. I don't think they could, so he was like a second father to me. He was very close. Took me to sporting events. Got me interested in baseball. One of the last memories, my uncle was a big baseball fan, and he was going to take me to the World Series the next year.
Wetzel had gone looking for the crash site 15 years ago, but he didn't find it until yesterday.
It was kind of emotional. Always wanted to see it.
For Fred Woods, this was his second trip to the site. His first time was a few days after the crash. He, too, was 9 years old at that time.
He walked us right to it. I do remember that there were shoes, women's purses that were all, you know, the belongings just scattered every which way. And, you know, for a kid 9 years of age, it was a big deal. And like I say, that was the first week of November 1959.
Joe Trecca of Scottsville came with his son to help return the wheel. He builds model planes in his spare time, and he learned about the crash when a coworker gave him Phil Bradley's memoir. Trecca said the ill-fated plane was a model DC-3.
It's been in service for a long time, and it was the first passenger-carrying plane that was successful for the airlines. It's got a lot of other names, too. They call it the Goonie Bird. Even after 60 years, they still use them. They used them in World War II. And then they were called the Dakota. They were used in the Vietnam War, so they're really a multi-purpose aircraft.
Mark Klein's cousin, Wanda Willis, also made the trek. She maintains a Facebook page commemorating Flight 349. She was 5 years old on that day and remembers her parents following the news coverage of the crash.
My dad, who had a musical background, decided to write a song about it. So he wrote his song, and he sang it for years, and it was a part of our family. And he finally was able to meet Phil Bradley. And when he met Phil, they connected right away, became very good friends. For me, it's emotional because of knowing that song for so long and knowing that Phil would have been so happy to get that wheel back here.
Willis didn't want to sing her father's song, but she was willing to recite some of the lyrics.
It was a night in October 1959. A big plane was flying of the Piedmont Airlines. Over the Blue Ridge Mountains, it was flying so high, then suddenly it was crashing to the mountainside.
Let me get on the upper side of that and hang on.
For WMRA News, I'm Randy Behagy.
You can learn more about that story at WMRA.org or through the WMRA app. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Halloween Thursday.